This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And it's our weekly Q&A with Layla. Can't believe it's already time for yet another edition of our weekly Q&A.
Yeah, didn't we just finish one?
I know, time flies when you're having fun. Yeah, absolutely. So, at any rate, you can reach us with questions. Radioprogram@AOL.com is the destination for questions. And we've got a whole slew of them in our mailbag. We encourage you to pose your questions. Say you are not disposed to listen to our live program on, by the way, that's some ambient noise from New York City out there, just to lend an air of authenticity to this podcast. We broadcast from our office here on, I guess it's the west side of Manhattan.
Right near Columbus Circle.
Near Columbus Circle, the very controversial Columbus Circle, because Columbus, you know, they might be taking down that statue, you know, because, you know, what it represents, the colonial oppression and so on and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, we're still here within view of Columbus Circle, and we're answering your questions. Radioprogram@AOL.com. Please send your questions. And so before we get to questions, there was an interesting story. This is a theme that we are from time to time called upon to revisit, which is the meat causes cancer controversy.
Yeah.
And this was something that was raised in the book, The China Study.
Yes.
By T. Colin Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
The assertion that using a high meat diet, and in particular dairy, was associated with cancer, and the World Health Organization really recently weighed in on this subject, saying that we should, on a global level, reduce our intake of animal protein.
Yes.
And so what's the latest?
Well, the latest is, well, this actually was out a year ago, and I'm wondering why it's posted now again today, but there's been some blowback from it, that the World Health Organization claims that red meat, processed meat, all cause cancer, all lumped into the same category. Now, there was a nice pushback by, and I don't recall that doctor's name, her website, but she did a really wonderful bit-by-bit taking down their whole argument about what kind of science they used, the fact that they cherry-picked. They used 29 epidemiological studies, but of the 29, 14 showed an association with red meat consumption and cancer, but 15 did not. Mm-hmm. So they did not finish the sentence number one.
Mm-hmm.
There were six controlled trials, three were human. The other three were rodent trials.
Well, you know, you don't see a lot of carnivorous rodents.
No.
And it might be bad for mice, although mice can eat anything.
Probably.
For mice to subsist, you know, I see all these experiments. They put mice on high-fat diets. And by the way, their version of a high-fat diet is about 30% carbohydrate. They just add some lard to their ordinary rat chow.
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure that rats are just going to eat pure ketogenic diet.
They're right.
Just, you know, they like grains. They, you know, they like carbs.
They like garbage.
Yeah, garbage. But they mostly garbage. like carby garbage.
Right.
You know,
right.
Starchy, carby stuff. You know, we're not, the analogy using these rat studies is a little bit hard to make.
Exactly. And exactly. Yeah. And with what little human studies there were or are, There's all kinds of methodology flaws, smaller sample sizes, using inadequate testing, using inadequate controls, having inadequate controls per study. And most of those human trials were actually done by the same research group. You want to be able to test something independently and see if you come out with a different result. It's going to be a little hard to do when it's the same research team that's doing the other studies. There can be some confirmation bias.
Right.
Or something like that.
You proceed from a certain
theory.
Yeah,
yeah. So that's a problem in methodology.
And of course, there's the influence of the sugar industry throughout, you know, which is something that I pointed out in a recent column in our newsletter, is that researchers were basically incentivized. I think that's a nice word for it. Bribed is a more kind of blunt word for it, to minimize the dangers of sugar and shift the onus to fat.
Yes.
And in particular, saturated fat.
Right.
And there were sort of two warring camps in the 1950s, and the researchers who were in favor of, I guess the meat industry had less clout than the sugar industry in this case.
And then there was the vegetable oil industry with the claim that polyunsaturated fats are heart healthy. To this day.
To replace still, saturated fats.
Yes, to replace the saturated.
To make you feel guilty about using butter and
right. So sugar industry, vegetable oil industry, here we go. And you could look at so much of published research that shows us that human consumption since the 1970s of both of these products has basically gone through the roof.
But also, I don't think meat consumption has gone up. I think it's actually somewhat gone down.
No, sugar and vegetable oil has gone up since the 1970s.
And yet the epidemiology of heart disease, actually I think heart disease is a little down because we have maybe better techniques of treating people who have heart attacks. Immediately, they don't die of heart attacks like they used to.
They have bypass, they have angioplasty.
Right, right. So maybe we're making some progress. But in terms of diabetes, in terms of obesity, we just keep getting fatter and more diabetic.
Right, right.
So I think another factor is, and we discussed this over lunch, is the politicization, is that a word? Politicization or politization of nutrition science.
Yes.
Because we think it's an exact science. You know, science is science. These are incontrovertible facts, but it's whose facts?
Right.
And, you know, it's like, I like my facts. I don't like your facts.
Ah, because they're alternative facts.
Right. They're it's fake news. It's fake news. So to speak to that issue, you know, the World Health Organization is a political organization. I mean, let's face it, they are for a form of global governance which seeks to minimize stress on resources. And I think one of the big buzzwords for we call them good organizations, is sustainability.
Yes.
And we think of the planet as having finite resources, and in a Malthusian way, you know, the population's going up, 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 and how do we feed all these people?
Yeah.
And we're polluting the environment by eating high on the food chain and eating meat. So therefore, we should eat more plant-based foods. They also have less of a carbon footprint, although that's controversial because...
We're made of carbon.
Hopefully we're made of carbon because then we're another life form from another planet, you know, nitrogen-based or something. But the idea is that you have less of a carbon footprint when you eat a tomato, say, than if you eat a beefsteak. And actually, some studies have shown that some foods that Westerners like to consume, like fruit in winter in Minneapolis or in Calgary, has a very high carbon footprint because it has to be jetted in fresh from Guatemala.
Right.
And
then on a truck.
Yeah.
Up the United States.
Air conditioned and what have you. And so this actually creates kind of a high carbon footprint for foods that we tend to think of as healthy plant-based foods.
Yeah.
So in some ways comparable to, you know, putting lots of animal feed into an animal that you're going to slaughter. And that, you know, meat is actually a fairly efficient delivery system for calories and for protein and for a wide variety of nutrients that humans need.
Carnitine, CoQ10, you don't get those in your vegetables and your fruits. Mm-hmm. Not much.
Right.
Anyway, so, and even this whole sustainability thing is now, or the move towards more plant-based diet is even happening on the local level here in New York with Mayor de Blasio.
Yes.
Instituting or...
Meatless Mondays.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
The idea being is let's get kids used to the idea of going without meat because this is in the interest of the world.
Yeah.
That, you know, we're moving towards that. So we recognize those kids aren't going to become vegans or vegetarians, but let's give a little bit of the experience of that, and maybe they'll opt for it because we want them to be good citizens and, you know, eat low on the food chain, reduce their carbon footprint, and so on.
Right.
Know, just like ride your bicycle and go have a meatless Monday.
Go have a meatless Monday.
You know, so we see that element, you know, I'm all for the protecting the planet, and I'm all
sure.
for, you know, keeping our carbon footprint low, and I don't want to pollute the environment with extravagant types of agriculture that devastate the environment or...
And deplete our soil
and cause
and
carbon
our toxic
dioxide.
And our toxic to our aquifer. And, yeah.
Right. Yep. But, you know, on the one hand, we're talking nutrition science, and on the one hand, we're talking environmental protection.
Mm-hmm.
And while they can go hand in hand... You can't really conflate them. You really, there should not be a tug
yes.
on the nutrition science.
They can't
because
be
some people
yeah.
say, look, I want to demonstrate, I'm for a plant-based diet and I want to demonstrate how bad meat is. I want to demonstrate how superior a plant-based diet is to a diet that includes meat for reasons other than the pure science of what does it do to the human body and our biology.
Right.
You're coming from a political or global sustainability perspective.
Mm-hmm. So the question is this, do you choose your health or your ideology, which is going to be a topic of what might the next newsletter or something that I'm going to write about. So
it's impossible to avoid bias.
Yeah,
in this area, it's impossible to avoid bias because food is such an individual thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's one thing if scientists discuss, you know, study, I don't know, cumulus clouds or something like that. Because you're not heavily invested in cumulus clouds. You don't eat them, you know, you like them, maybe you watch them, but you're not in it. But when you study nutrition, the guys who study nutrition, or the gals who study nutrition, they go to lunch break and they order out food.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to partake of food culture and food preferences
yes.
in their lives. It's hard to separate that out.
Yeah.
So, and we are prey to that too, you know, because we have our own biases. Hopefully our biases are informed by the science because
yes.
we constantly look at the science.
We have to. Otherwise, we're not worthy of our credentials.
Right.
As
and
I
we
like to say.
Question and, you know, if we were to see conclusively, and there's plenty of opportunities for us to switch gears because we see studies like this come down the pike and we can say, oh, you know, the study says that meat causes cancer, so we'll stop giving meat to our patients. We don't want our patients to get cancer.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not convinced by those.
Right. Exactly. So until the studies are more definitive, until the methodology is far better than even a little flawed.
Or even if they did studies where the kind of meat that I eat is organic, grass-fed, and it's not processed.
Right.
So I don't eat a lot of Oscar Mayer wieners or, you know, Boar's Head salami.
Yeah.
You know, even though maybe that brand is... I'm just picking a recognized brand. I'm not impugning it by any means, but it's processed and possibly chemicalized and the source is not organic or grass-fed.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's the distinction, that therein lies the problem. Although even sometimes looking at processed meat that's not, you know, grass-fed or organic, it's hard for them to find a big problem.
That's true. That's why of the 29 epidemiological studies, 15 found no association, whereas 14 found an association. And epidemiology, as we know, is not the thing to look at for cause and effect.
So you need to lock people up in a room.
Randomize, double-blind,
and look at every morsel
RCTs.
Of food that they eat, because they cheat on these diet questionnaires, look exactly what they eat.
They always want to give you the right answer.
So And follow them for 30 years, or 50 years,
good luck with that.
And you know, and it would have to be not... You know, 50 people, it would have to be 10,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Who would sign up for that?
Nobody.
Free food for 50 years.
Scientists might, that's unlimited grant.
You have to eat all your meals from the laboratory. You can't sneak it out. You can't go to a fast food place. You can't.
That's really the only way to do it. And that's why it makes studying nutrition science next to impossible, mm-hmm. really, to do it.
To do it with great precision.
You can't, with any precision, you can't control for all the variables of.
And what's a placebo hamburger? Well, I guess, how do you make a placebo? Because it's got to be double-blind placebo controlled, right?
Right. So we're not going to know that that's a tofu burger or some other kind of.
You can tell.
Yeah.
I used to be vegan. When I was vegan, I would have tofurkey for Thanksgiving.
Tofurkey, yeah.
That's how committed I was.
Yeah. Did you like it? I've tasted that.
I kind of took one for the team.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Pass that hydrolyzed vegetable protein. Gluten source, you say? Oh, okay. Well,
if you put it up, soy and MSG in it, it's got, some flavor.
Oh, well, umami, definitely. Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
The MSG flavor. Anyway.
And you can make the stuffing.
Uh-huh.
The stuffing is good.
Uh-huh.
That's vegetarian.
Right.
Just skip the sausage. Don't put the sausage
that's
in.
That's it. Right. You got your breadcrumbs and your celery and your water chestnuts and... Mm-hmm. We're not doing any seafood, right? So, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Vegan.
Well, on that note.
Let's get to questions.
Yes. All right. We have an email here from Bo. Very thoughtful what he says here. I truly believe that many overeating and obesity problems are a brain problem. And that some signal says more and more, even if you're full. I notice that sometimes when I eat, I keep eating a lot, even though I'm not hungry. It's not emotional or anything like that, but rather I can't control myself. It's like my brain isn't satisfied.
Yes.
Do you agree with this concept?
Oh.
Is there a supplement that can help with this?
Oh, my goodness. He so nailed it. But it's more complex than that. There's a gut-brain interaction.
Yeah.
And the brain has the ability to sense blood sugar very, very well. And what's come out recently... is, and I talked about it on my weekend program, I'll reiterate it here, is it's kind of a new think about hypoglycemia or low blood sugar. Mm-hmm. This popular diagnosis in the 1960s and 70s, Carlton Fredericks talked about it, and it was basically poo-pooed. It's like, you feel that you're brain dead when your blood sugar is low, and that ordinary people don't have that. Yes, people with certain diseases have that, or if you're diabetic and you use too much insulin, but ordinary people don't have that. They have it.
They do.
So it's a real phenomenon. And, we help people with fatigue and anxiety and moodiness and irritability by stabilizing their blood sugar big time. Because that's what happens to the brain when there's low blood sugar. So what they actually determined, they did a very interesting experiment. They took thin people and they took overweight and diabetic people. Mm-hmm. And to make it precise, they injected them with precisely the same amount of glucose, pure sugar. So it wasn't eating. It wasn't eat this donut. Because it might vary how you process it.
Digestive juices.
They mainlined it. It was like a heroin shot of sugar into the vein.
Mm-hmm.
And then they measured their blood sugar levels, and I don't know quite how they do this, in the brain.
Huh.
In the brain. And what they found is that, interestingly, in diabetics who generally have a higher blood sugar response to sugar, the brain levels of sugar with the same amount of sugar were lower, and the same thing for the obese people. So what that suggests is that it's harder for an overweight person or a diabetic person or even maybe a pre-diabetic person to attain optimal levels of blood sugar.
Yeah. Insulin resistance of the brain.
And that's why they're less satisfied. And they just want to eat more. That's number one.
Yeah.
Number two, there are some studies now that show that there's a rewiring of the brain that occurs. It's very similar to what happens with addictive drugs when you use a lot of sugar, when you binge on sugar. And maybe you don't even have to quite binge. Maybe just, carbon out on...
Maybe you're just going to have a donut.
Yeah, too much in the way of, bagels.
Yeah.
Or cold cereal. It might be similar.
Yeah.
The brain changes. Certain parts of the brain resemble the brains of cocaine addicts and alcoholics. And probably people like Harvey Weinstein who obtain gratification in other ways.
Uh-huh.
Because it's the part of the brain that exercises control and restraint. So you get impulsivity and more susceptibility to respond to food cues.
Yeah.
Now, there's actually a genetic basis for that, too, is we can now do genetic tests that tell us that a certain population, some people, have genetic susceptibility to respond more to food cues or to have less satiety signals.
Yes.
We're actually getting the point of knowing which genes do that.
Right, right.
So it absolutely is a brain craving.
Yes.
It's also, just like those rat experiments, it's like Pavlovian conditioning, classic Pavlovian conditioning. You push the button and you get a treat.
Mm-hmm.
And you push that, it's called reinforcement. You reinforce and reinforce and reinforce that pathway. Mm-hmm. And that pathway becomes almost like a very, very embedded pathway in your brain.
Now add to that the food science end of it, where food industry, all kinds of fast food, even chain restaurants, where the foods have become so hyper palatable that you're not even tasting all those calories going down because you barely have to chew your food anymore.
Right.
That your brain simply wants more.
And that's called called food science.
Yeah.
And there's actually a branch of the food industry which is designed to create those flavors that are irresistible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you see that in the ads too. It's irresistible.
Yeah.
Now, do you really want to make all your food irresistible? In the same time, turn the channel and there's a diet commercial.
Yeah.
The food in the previous commercial was irresistible. Now you need to diet.
Now you need to diet. And we'll see more of that on January 2nd.
Right. Remorse.
Probably.
Remorse.
Probably.
Yeah. So,
So, Bo, yes, we do believe you. We do agree with this concept. Number one thing to do is to stop.
Because you can remodel and
you
rechange.
Can remodel
through
it,
neuroplasticity, you can reach. You can change.
You can create new neural pathways. This is the good news of all this. A very helpful supplement for that is also L-glutamine.
So another factor is your insulin production. When you're producing a lot of insulin, it exerts a downward push on your blood sugar.
Yep.
So it takes a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish you could visualize that. I have my hands clasped together like in prayer. And I have blood sugar and insulin are compatible when you are eating a lot of sugar and making a lot of insulin. You stop eating the sugar, you pull away from your insulin production. But your insulin production doesn't go down right away.
Yeah.
It takes a while, maybe a few days or a couple of weeks, perhaps a month, for your insulin to go down.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you're not providing that much sugar, but it's exerting a downward push on your sugar. So you are feeling like, oh my God, I need it.
I need, I'm craving horrendously.
Yeah.
You're so hungry you can't get enough food on your fork.
Right.
You're hangry.
Right.
And nothing's going to cut it. The chicken and broccoli you had planned for yourself is no longer going to cut it. You're going to stop at the pizzeria.
Yeah.
You may stop at the donut shop.
Take a chromium pill. Good luck. And it's not going to help that
much. It's not going to help that,
5-hydroxytryptophan maybe attenuates that a little bit in the brain.
Mm.
That some studies have shown it attenuates sweet craving. What do you do for sweet craving?
I don't have sweet craving. I have
starch
craving.
What do you do for your patients, obviously?
Oh, for patients?
Yeah.
Well, I tell them, first of all, who are really not able to break the sugar habit, I have them take lots of L-glutamine.
Okay, glutamine.
As much as 9 or 15
and
or even 20 a day.
Glutamine is a gluconeogenic amino acid, right?
Mm-hmm.
It goes
mm-hmm.
to sugar production.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And what happens is that it can help combat cravings. There's been old scientific research now that showed it's helped with cravings for alcohol, which is a proxy to sugar.
Right.
And therefore, it can also help with sugar cravings.
So you have to take like teaspoons of glutamine in water. It's sweet tasting.
It's sweet tasting. You could take it in the powder form or you could take it in the capsule form.
Okay.
A lot of my patients, they're on the go.
Okay.
Take it in capsule forms. Wait about 10, 15 minutes. Then go eat something. No, don't go eat that donut. Go get some chicken salad. Mm-hmm. On a better arugula.
The other thing to keep in mind is it will pass.
It will pass.
You know, because if you can get through that 5 minutes
of,
get
I really
through
wanna,
it.
Right.
And it's amazing because it's like,
it passes.
You equilibrate.
Right, right, right. And bottom line, what's going to happen if you don't fulfill that craving? You're not going to explode.
No,
your life doesn't take a turn for the worse.
So much of our conditioning is you've got to deal with it. Got to deal with
instant
it.
Instant gratification.
Yeah, well, it's that, but it's also like, oh, this is a bad or dangerous sensation I'm having. I'm hungry.
Yeah.
I have to fix that.
Right.
And, you know, what I try to do...
Our bodies need to be fixed.
Somewhat facetiously at a lecture recently, and I actually have a column that's buried in the archives, hunger is my friend.
Yes.
And it's, you know, I was lecturing, and it just occurred to me is that when people are hungry, they should chant the mantra, hunger is my friend. Hunger is my friend. Why? Because you're burning down fat during that time.
Glucagon is out.
And it's okay, because it's a natural state. I mean, yes, we're taught in civilization that we should never be hungry.
Right.
Like, we talk about the homeless, the hungry. Oh, my God. You know, okay. I don't want to minimize that or trivialize it.
Yeah.
But hunger is not a... emergency.
It's not an emergency. And a lot of good things happen when we're hungry. We're burning fat, number one. Yes,
caloric
Dr.
Caloric restriction, intermittent fasting.
Yes, all the repair that can happen in the body.
A reboot to metabolism and immunity.
It's a little bit of a cleansing to some degree. We're able to get rid of toxins when we're not chronically and constantly digesting our food. We could detoxify a little bit better.
And it may have benefits in terms of cancer, too.
Yes. A ketogenic diet is very helpful that way.
But as a proxy for ketogenic diet, I spoke to Miriam Kalamian about this in her book, Keto for Cancer. She said some people do intermittent fasting or some, like a 5-2 diet, you know, which is eat normally for 5 days, but eat well.
Yeah.
And 2 days, very minimal calories, maybe 400 or 500 calories in those days. That's like intermittent fasting. Or go longer between your last meal, stop at 7, and have your next meal at noon.
Yes. That's, go that 16 or 17 hours, which is often very helpful.
But it's tough to do that when you're in the state that this guy's in. You have to change.
That's true.
You have to turn around the Titanic, because you're headed for an iceberg. It's very hard to turn around the Titanic.
Right.
They saw the iceberg coming.
Yeah.
They couldn't turn around. You see all those movies. It's, oh my God, it's like, it is such a poignant metaphor for disaster. You can see it looming. And you try to evade it, but there's a critical momentum towards diabetes, obesity, and you lose your health. It's hard to steer and turn it around, but you can.
But you can. You can. You simply have to make up your mind to do that. You have to snuggle up to that feeling of hunger and make it your warm and fuzzy friend.
Okay.
You have to reframe it for yourself. And not think it's some negative, oh, my stomach is empty.
Wait.
I'm hungry, I'm starving, I'm going to fall down.
That's
no, you're not.
A yogic concept because it's like
you have to reframe
some positions that I'm in, they're painful, they're aversive, I don't want to be there. And then I kind of go, breathe into it. Breathe into it. Be there.
Just
be okay with it.
Be okay. Don't judge it.
Yeah.
You just simply let it be.
Yeah.
People who do yoga have less issues with hunger and craving than people who don't. It's true. It's true. And it's a wonderful practice.
Because they create a state of mindfulness and a state of resilience to sometimes, sensations that are complex or aversive.
Yeah.
Anyway, enough said on that subject. Okay, good time to break because we are going over time for part one. Let's reserve some time for questions in part two. What's coming up?
How do I know if I'm absorbing my vitamins? How can I tell?
Okay, good question for part two. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with our nutritionist in residence, Layla Mutin, answering your questions. You can send questions to radioprogram@aol.com. Prompt a discussion by sending your questions. We'll be back in just a moment.